Welcome back to the Young Turks. Another week without Cenk. I'm John Adarola. Anna Kasparian joining me. We're going to be doing both hours together. Mm-hmm. It's a big show. It's going to be a big week.
Yes.
It's cool though because you're going to see some faces you don't get to see nearly enough. I believe Wednesday, you and myself and JR are doing the first hour.
Yeah.
So I'm excited for that. That should be cool. We've got Maz Jobrani coming back.
Yes.
And a few other people possible for Friday. I'm not sure that we know for sure.
Yeah.
But it's exciting.
I'm excited for the week. I know Cenk's not going to be here. I don't know why. He has like business CEOs type stuff to do, I'm guessing. But it's exciting because you're right. We get to have some new faces on the show. We get to start and end things on time. It's going to be great.
Yeah. Yeah. Though, I have to keep it real with you. I'm tense at the beginning of this week. So, I mean, we had the strikes in Syria, and we're going to talk about that a lot. But now we. Like any minute now, something crazy could happen. I mean, that's always possible, especially since inauguration. But I feel tense because with Donald Trump in the White House and his whims and his emotional outbursts, you never know what's going to happen. So we've got a lot of news to cover, but it's not impossible that we have to break that we've gone to war with some random country.
Right.
But anyway, let's jump into some news from around the world. Two adults are allegedly dead and two students were injured earlier today at another shooting at San Bernardino, this time at the elementary school. That was earlier today. We know very little about the situation. It's alleged to have been a murder-suicide. And we do know that one of those who were killed was a special education teacher. So another tragedy for a community that has barely bounced back from the previous mass shooting that happened there not too long ago. A new review of the bleaching of the Great Barrier Reef shows that two consecutive mass bleaching events over the past few years have affected a 1,500 kilometer stretch of the reef, leaving only the southern third of it relatively unaffected. So I know there's some disagreement about the actual extent of the bleaching, but we're talking about huge distances at the very least where the acidification and the increased temperature of the ocean is starting to have a large impact. And obviously, you can't exaggerate how many species depend on the reefs for their habitat. Huge ecological impact there. Egypt has imposed a state of emergency following a series of bombings of Coptic churches on Palm Sunday across the country, both near Cairo, also in the north and Alexandria. More than 50 have been killed in those series of bombings. And terrorist attacks against Coptic churches are nothing new in Egypt. But I also saw some news over the weekend, late Sunday night. It was blood drives being done for the victims there outside of Cairo. People pitching in to try to help those who'd been affected by that. So obviously huge tragedy, also an opportunity for those in that country from very different religions to band together. And finally, following a meeting with the Chinese president at Mar-a-Lago this weekend, Donald Trump came out of the meeting saying that they had made, quote, tremendous progress on a number of issues. I don't know exactly what he's talking about there. Might be that he's trying to get more trademarks given to him by the Chinese government. The Chinese state-run news agency, though, declared immediately afterward that his attacks in Syria are, quote, the act of a weakened man who needed to flex his muscles. And so perhaps his prediction that they're laughing at us around the world is coming true with him as president.
So just a little more context into that. So the leader of China kind of was hush-hush as the situation in Syria unfolded. And then he waited until he got into China and he said what he said. And I was amused by that, right? I was amused by it because what he said, I believe, is accurate. I think it's an accurate description of Donald Trump and what he does. And look, we're going to delve into Syria very soon. But before we do so, I just want to quickly note that one of the worst ways to react to anything is through emotion. You should never let your emotion dictate how you react to something as serious as foreign policy if you are the leader of the United States. And that's exactly what Trump did. But anyway, we'll get to that and more in just a second.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see when it comes to China what tremendous progress they made. Certainly, there are areas where he could do a lot of good for our economy, theoretically, or he could just try to benefit his own businesses that operate in China or those of his family. I'm worried that he'll take that easier road, unfortunately. Okay, but as you said, why don't we jump into Syria? Quite a few developments there. After last week's cruise missile strike on an air base in Syria, this weekend was relatively quiet. there were rumblings, diplomatic rumblings, concerning news coming out, but no further action, at least that was made clear to us. There are some rumors about the death of one of the Syrian pilots who flew the mission. I don't believe that those are confirmed at this point, but it doesn't seem like there were any additional strikes, at least against Assad regime material or bases. And so now we're left wondering, what are the next steps? I mean, they've said that there's likely to be further action. We know that Russia is saying that there will be consequences for what we did. But Donald Trump doesn't seem to be making clear what he's going to do. And so we're left looking at some of his most high profile foreign policy representatives. And even they don't seem to know exactly what's going to happen now. So here we're going to have Nikki Haley, ambassador to the UN. And she makes pretty clear that there are going to be extremely large consequences for the Assad regime.
Is regime change in Syria now the official policy of the United States?
So there's multiple priorities. It's getting Assad out is not the only priority. And so what we're trying to do is obviously defeat ISIS. Secondly, we don't see a peaceful Syria with Assad in there. Thirdly, get the Iranian influence out. And then finally move towards a political solution, because at the end of the day, this is a complicated situation. There are no easy answers, and a political solution is going to have to happen. But we know that it is not going to be, there's not any sort of option where a political solution is going to happen with Assad at the head of the regime.
But is the position of the Trump administration that he cannot be ruler of Syria anymore? Regime change is the policy.
Well, the regime change is something that we think is going to happen, because all of the parties are going to see that Assad's not the leader that needs to be taking place for Syria. So what I think you're seeing is, this isn't about policy or not, this is about thoughts. And so when you look at the thoughts, there is no political solution that any of us can see with Assad at the lead.
Okay, so that at the very least is true. You don't simply have a political solution. They keep throwing that around because they want you to be focused on the political solution rather than the military attempts to solve the problem that they've already started and might continue as well. Obviously, there's no political solution without a military solution. That's why he's been engaged in the civil war for half a decade now at this point. But if you're worried about escalation of our conflict against the Syrian regime, I mean, she made very clear it's going to happen.
Right.
Now, devil's advocate, she could be alluding to the fact that if we can convince Russia, then Russia can take him out. Good luck with that.
Right. I mean, Russia has no incentive to take him out. Right now, Russia is one of Assad's allies. Okay. Mm-hmm. And Russia took part in specifically going after civilians in this really brutal war. So I don't believe in a second or for a second that Russia would take any part in getting Assad out or playing a role in regime change. But the most important thing to take away from that interview was that Nikki Haley believes that the Trump administration is going to push for regime change. Mm-hmm. And so right now there's a lot of confusion about what Trump's strategy is, because he went from criticizing the Obama administration several years ago and claiming that Obama should not under any circumstance get involved in what was happening in Syria. And then he seemed to take a very, I wouldn't say favorable, but he seemed like he was very much in favor of focusing on America, not getting involved in the Syrian conflict. And then out of nowhere, because he saw the chemical attack videos, he decided, okay, no, we got to do something, and then proceeds to do the missile strike. Mm-hmm. So what is the strategy? What happens next? What kind of impact has his action taken so far? And what does everyone else in his administration say right now? She's the UN ambassador, right? Mm-hmm. But now we're about to hear from someone else who has a very different take on what the administration is planning on doing.
Yeah, so why don't we turn now to Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who is going to disagree with Nikki Haley in fairly fundamental fashion on what needs to happen going forward.
Well, I think those continued actions by Bashar al-Assad clearly call into any question of him expecting to have any legitimacy to continue as the leader of Syria. I think the issue of how Bashar al-Assad's leadership is sustained or how he departs is something that we will be working with allies and others in the coalition.
Is it a priority of U.S. policy to get him out of power?
Our priority in Syria, John, really hasn't changed. I think the president's been quite clear. First and foremost, we must defeat ISIS.
So in terms of President Assad, you had said that there has been no change in policy as a result of this attack. So it is still true then that his fate is to be determined, as you said previously, by the Syrian people.
Yes, John, I think, you know, obviously the United States' own founding principles are self-determination. And I think what the United States and our allies want to do is to enable the Syrian people to make that determination. Now, we've seen what violent regime change looks like in Libya and the kind of chaos that can be unleashed and indeed the kind of misery that it enacts on its own people. It's important that we keep our priorities straight, and we believe that the first priority is the defeat of ISIS.
And just to be clear, before we go a bit wider, I mean, there they're talking about whether it should be up to the Syrian people to decide their fate, which is fine, and we love to speak in those terms. But let's be clear at this point, there might have been a narrow window at one point where the Syrian people were engaged in an attempt to either politically change the regime, eventually starting the civil war. But not too long after that, just a few years after that, their ability to do it all on their own was taken away, and not just because of the brutal actions of Assad, but also the wide-scale intervention by Russia, the fact that they began supporting him militarily and also economically. Mm-hmm. So at that point, it becomes a fiction to say that the Syrian people get to decide. Well, yes, technically, against Assad, who's crushing them militarily, and one of the most powerful military forces around the globe. So technically, they get to decide. But anyway, there he's saying the policy hasn't actually changed.
Right, he's saying.
Has he spoken to Nikki Haley?
That's the thing.
Has she spoken to Trump?
But that's exactly the right question to ask, because even within his administration, you see different messaging from different people. And you'll see them go on cable news, do these interviews, and further confuse the American people about what Trump's strategy, if there is any strategy, will be and how he'll proceed forward. It seems like things happen very spontaneously, mm-hmm. and that's a very dangerous way to go about Syria, which, by the way, I concede is one of the most difficult foreign policy issues facing the world today. I don't know what the proper measures are, right? Mm-hmm. I know that what Trump did with the missiles last week was not effective. It didn't accomplish anything. If anything, it escalated conflict in a way that was haphazard and wasn't well thought out. But it's important to understand all the different factions that play a role in Syria. It's not just the rebels, Assad. Whose side are you on? No, it's much more complicated than that. There are, you know, various countries that have decided to ally themselves with either Assad or the rebels. Then you have
the terrorist groups,
exactly. And so there's so many players here, and I'm not convinced that someone like Trump is sophisticated enough to understand the nuances of this civil war, understand all the players, and I also don't have faith in Trump in terms of uniting all the people that are supposed to be collaborating with him, advising him, and you know, essentially getting briefed effectively enough to make a smart decision. So right now, as you can see from these two different interviews, you have two different theories on how the Trump administration should move forward, and I have no idea what's going to happen. Everything seems very spontaneous, and there's no, you know, uniting front within the Trump administration.
Yeah, it seems like they don't know either, and that seems crazy to say, but do we have any reason to believe that Trump has actually sat down and spoken or gotten on the phone and spoken with either Tillerson or Nikki Haley?
We
don't have that. Like, I agree, Trump isn't sophisticated enough to understand the situation in Russia, and he's not curious enough to find out about it, even after we've engaged with the Assad regime. And so, look, my fear immediately after the missiles were launched late last Thursday was that he will see this as a great opportunity to get us embroiled in a military conflict, which unfortunately the media will probably largely back him on. The people, the American people, historically have been very supportive of presidents during a time of war, especially if the danger of that enemy is hyped up to them. And we already know that in a recent poll, 51% of the American public supports the military strikes against Syria, which is not, those are not incredible numbers. Mm-hmm. And you're seeing a weird mix of Republicans and Democrats supporting that there. And that option is still possible. I mean, we could find out, you know, that we've sent in 10,000 troops tomorrow. Trump has said that he will not tell us until afterward when he engages in those sorts of actions. But there is a lot of danger in that path. I mean, something could happen with Russia, US troops could be lost, and that's damaging to him too. So it's not impossible at this point that he'll take the small boost to his approval that he's already gotten. Mm-hmm. People saying that he looks presidential and look, he'll do decisive action, and he might actually back off, especially considering how disinterested he is in Syria to begin with.
Can I please jump in with this whole notion that President Trump looks more presidential because of what he did? If acting based on emotion and acting in a spontaneous fashion without getting the proper briefings necessary from intelligence organizations is what makes you appear presidential, then we have extremely low standards in this country for what presidential means, right? Anyone who went on television and supported this and thought it was a good idea is a questionable commentator, to say the least, right? And look, everyone makes mistakes in their commentary and their analysis of the news, so I'm not trying to be too judgy about it. But I just want to be clear, right now, what's happening in Syria and this escalation by the Trump administration will have significant costs. And who knows where it will lead? Who knows how many members of our military will have to get involved in a situation that wasn't well thought out, right? And so this is not presidential. It's kind of like being on a high school campus and seeing a bully throw the first punch, and then someone says, that's what a real student does. That student looks like a real student.
No,
what does that even mean?
That guy looks student body presidential.
Yeah, that student body presidential because he took a strong action or strong act. Like, this is not presidential to me. Presidential is showing leadership, showing that you are properly equipped with the knowledge necessary to make a smart decision. And in this case, it did not seem like a smart decision. Trump himself said, I saw those videos. And he got emotional and he made a decision based on that. Yeah. That is not presidential.
Yeah, well, it's easy to get away with that sort of thing when the vast majority of Trump supporters were polled and they said that this is consistent with his past statements on what should happen in Syria. And we've shown you over and over the many quotes, both in video form, his 13 tweets attacking Obama for possibly getting involved in Syria. I mean, this is the political context that we exist in. And I think that he is aware of how little memory there is amongst his supporters, how little interest there is in consistency amongst his supporters. Thankfully, our audience is a little bit more self-aware than that. And I don't know where it's gonna go from here. There's some rumblings, some rumors about further developments coming out today. An unnamed military official, so that's always a good beginning to a sentence, saying that they have now confirmed that Russia was aware of the chemical attack before it happened.
Yeah.
They haven't gone on record, they haven't presented the evidence. At this point, there's no reason to believe that, but that is now out there. Is that something that Trump is going to run with? Are they going to present evidence? I have no idea, it might be on tomorrow's show.
And one final thing that I wanted to comment on, I know we've gone too long. So I just find it fascinating that members of Congress did not make a big deal about the fact that they were not notified about what Trump was about to do, right? So Trump is able to act unilaterally if a country poses an imminent threat to the United States. We all know that Syria did not pose an imminent threat to the United States, but again, he acted unilaterally in what he did. Mm-hmm. And so if any other president, let's say President Hillary Clinton, had done the exact same thing that Trump did without notifying Congress, without asking them for their advice, their opinion, their support, I feel like Congress would be speaking or singing a very different tune right now. Okay,
so I think even more Democrats would be backing her up, even though a lot of Democrats backed up Trump on the strikes, elected Democrats I'm talking about. I think fewer Republicans would, but I bet some would.
Because
they still want that money going to the defense contractors. I think that that's one of the few bipartisan issues in DC. Start a war, people are gonna get paid, both the defense contractors and then you through them are going to get paid. I think she could reach across the aisle with some strikes on
Syria.
She
probably could, but I just want to really emphasize how deeply everything is politicized right now and how polarized Congress is, or not just Congress, politics in general in the United States, but you know, in Congress and the executive branch. And I just feel like Republicans would make such a big deal out of a Democratic leader acting unilaterally in a similar situation.
Yeah.
Just wanna put that out there. I could be wrong, that's just speculation.
You're probably right, I mean they did it with Obama.
Yeah.
Including Trump, by the way. Anyway, we do have to take our first break. Hashtag TRT Live. You can send us messages what you think about this first story. A little bit more updates on Syria for you. And then we've got our final story of the day is going to be the incredible legal costs that police departments across the country are accruing because of illegality perpetrated by their officers. The numbers are amazing. We'll have that for you a little bit later on. Welcome back to the show, everybody. Lots more to get to. We, like the US might be soon, are embroiled in Syria right now on the show. But we want to read some of your tweets. One coming in from El Duende Chingon saying,
"You're not saying it right."
I'm not going to go crazy. That's Jenk's thing.
El Duende Chingon.
Okay. There you go. Saying, "Depose Saddam, ISIS rises. Assad fights ISIS, depose Assad seems legit. But maybe depose Assad, blankety blank rises. Then you have to depose somebody else. Who knows? It's an endless loop. It's almost like it's designed to be that way." Tom Sherry says, "Unfortunately, it's very presidential starting an illegal war based on false evidence." That's true. So far, I am not in the camp that thinks that the chemical weapons attack did not happen. There are people on the left and the right with conspiracy theories. It could be right. If evidence comes out, I'll listen. At this point, it doesn't seem like it based on all the video and all that. And let's see. Dmore315 says Syria is a clusterfuck. I don't see any positive outcome for decades. Rather have zero US bombs kill people so they're not mad later.
His name's Dmore?
Mm-hmm. It's just a handle. And I agree. I think that there is obviously a best option. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that is. And I think that even the best option results in a lot of dead civilians, possibly a lot of dead soldiers.
It's difficult. And the thing is, you know, when we're covering that story and I'm critical of Trump, it's not like I'm saying or supporting the chemical attack, right? And I think it's a difficult story to comment on because what you say can get misconstrued as either supporting Assad or supporting, you know, factions within the rebellion that are terrible. You know what I'm saying? So it's such a complicated story and it's so difficult to have like a black or white take on it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well let's jump back into it. It was revealed this weekend that Donald Trump might have personally profited from the missile strikes against an air base in Syria. Now, we don't know for sure. I want to make that clear up front. Some people are reporting this as fact. It appears that he might have personally profited. Here is how. According to Trump's financial disclosure reports filed with the FEC back in 2015, thanks to the presidential election, his stock portfolio at that time included investments in technology firms, financial institutions, and defense firms, including Raytheon, a name that you might have seen in the news recently since they made the missiles that Donald Trump fired into Syria. Now, they are not the only US company that produces cruise missiles. They produce these particular ones. Now, he could have theoretically sold his stock in the time between 2015 and now. A smart president would have to avoid possible conflicts of interest or at least the appearance of conflicts of interest. But I ask you this, does Donald Trump give an F about that? No. And they could present the information. He could release his taxes, he could do a full financial disclosure, and he could allay our fears that this guy might literally profit from the US going to war. They choose not to do that. And we have seen nothing since the inauguration that should lead us to believe that he would not personally profit in this way. Now, how might he profit? Well, let's take a look at this. This is a recent timeline of Raytheon stock price. See that little uptick? Yeah, that was as soon as the market resumed trading the morning after the strikes. Now, people said that that represented for Raytheon an addition of $1 billion of value, which is true. Now, to be fair, if you expand the timeline, it's not like this is a record high for Raytheon. They had been sort of on the downslope. Now they're going back up. So let's not go crazy, but that is $1 billion. And if you look at five of the biggest defense contractors in the US, many had similar upticks, not all of them. And I did the research. I went through all the stocks I could think of, but some of them did. And for about four or five of those, it represented $5 billion being added to the value of their corporations, thanks to the strikes in Syria. Now, he has Raytheon stock. He might well have stock in Lockheed and Boeing and all of those. And if he doesn't, or whether he does or not, I guarantee the people that he's close with do. His nuclear family probably does as well. This is one of the scams that they get to run, that they throw US weapons at Syria, weapons we pay for, they personally profit, And if it comes to the point where US soldiers actually have to die, they're not serving, they're not going to Syria. It's a perfect racket.
It is, it is. And look, as you perfectly mentioned, it's speculation to say that he has profited from the recent uptick in the stock price for Raytheon, because we don't know. He could have sold that stock. But I would counter that notion with the fact that anyone who invests in stock and wants to see, you know, their investment grow knows that probably the most stable stock in the United States is anything related to weapons manufacturers, because we have, you know, an industrial military complex. Like, we love the fact that we can continuously go to war. We have industries that continuously make money off of us starting wars, continuing wars, escalating wars. So I would find it hard to believe that he would, you know, sell those stocks. But who knows? He might have. So it's, you have to be fair to him and state what the speculation is and what the facts are.
Well, I've been very clear on the record, I will not be fair to him.
Right.
But I will say, it's likely that if we had all the information, this is probably one of the instances of corruption from Donald Trump where he profited less. I believe that there are other areas, like the trademarks in China, some of the real estate deals, the hotel in DC, the way that Mar-a-Lago is making just hundreds of thousands of dollars extra every single week because of his activities there. Those are far worse. But we bring this up because I want you to understand the breadth of the potential for corruption, that it's not simply in his business, like real estate. It extends to almost every area, and that is why it's so crucial for us to get access to his finances, including, perhaps most importantly, his tax returns. Now, there are a lot of people who have given up on that. We tried to get it, and now some are saying, why are we focusing so much on that?
That's,
we're focusing on this because the potential for conflicts of interest are horrifying and worse than they've ever been. Every politician can be influenced by their donors. We fight that on a daily basis here at TYT. But not every politician can be personally enriched through corruption. Generally, they at least have to wait until they become a lobbyist or until the donations come in. But Donald Trump, every day that the market operates, gets to benefit from the corruption based on his actions. And that's why we need far more information, far more disclosure on his finances. And that's why we have to fight for it. And you have an opportunity, actually. In just a couple of days, it's going to be tax day. There are massive marches going on across the country for tax day to get him to release his taxes. I want to see those numbers swell so big that the media has to report on him, put pressure on him. Whether he actually releases the taxes or not, it can make him look like the corrupt SOB that he actually is. And that's why I want to see people participating in those marches.
Let me just be clear about one thing, though. I think that the Americans who are saying that we're focusing way too much on asking him to disclose his financial dealings and his tax documents are just conditioned by a corrupt political system. They're so used to it that they don't even see how devastating these conflicts of interest can be for the safety of Americans, by the way. If he's making military decisions and foreign policy decisions based on how he can profit personally, well, he's going to put innocent Americans, you know, on the line in military interventions throughout the world. So keep that in mind. But also, look, the lack of transparency in this administration is unlike anything that we've seen before, because there's a lack of transparency in every administration, right? But keep in mind that he doesn't want to deal with the media, right? During these press conferences, they want to shut out specific types of questions. And if anyone in the media has the audacity to push back against anyone in the administration, they go ahead and, you know, defame them as much as they can as fake news, as an illegitimate news source, this and that. So there's that part of it. Right now, there are watchdog groups that are fighting tooth and nail to get the Trump administration to do what the Obama administration did, which is publish information about the lobbying groups that meet with Trump in the White House. He refuses to do that, okay? Obama did do that, okay?
Yeah.
I didn't even know about it as he was president, but that's important information for us to know. Which lobbyists is he meeting with?
Yeah.
What interest groups are influencing his decision making? So the lack of transparency is something that we should have expected, especially considering the fact that he decided that he would not share any financial information of his, including his tax documents.
Yeah. Now, I want to turn to one more angle on the Syria situation. This is a really interesting development that surprised me when I saw it, but we should not have been surprised. We should have expected this. Many Donald Trump supporters believed him when he said during the campaign that he was going to be a non-interventionist. He wasn't going to be a George W. Bush. He was going to largely keep us out of the Middle East and these other unnecessary conflicts that cost so much money and we lose so many lives. He was going to be America first. And then these serious strikes happen, and there's the prospect of more. And look, I warned people for well over a year that the idea that he wasn't going to get us involved in foreign wars is absolutely ridiculous. It was a crazy thing to believe. He said he wanted to occupy countries to take their natural resources. So I wasn't surprised when he launched these strikes, but some of his supporters were. And so people felt, well, he might actually lose a lot of his support. But it turns out that they are masters at mental gymnastics, and they've come up with a way to not blame Donald Trump for the actions Donald Trump has taken. And wait until you see what they've all independently come down on. So this is David Duke, big Trump supporter, who said this. This is they're making war against Syrian President Bashar Assad in Syria and the Christians of Syria for the purposes of Jewish extremism. Trump's Jewish son-in-law wants to take over his empire. So there is actually Kushner and Ivanka Trump. So Donald Trump's not responsible for what he did. His son-in-law made him launch those strikes, and they just happen to be Jewish. Isn't that odd? We have the Daily Stormer, if you know anything about white supremacy, you know what they're about, concluded that the most likely reason for Trump to take the move against Syria was that he was being manipulated by Jews and the deep state intelligence community in a devious manner. So they haven't totally given up on the whole deep state thing, but now they've started to involve Jewish people into it. Let's see, Alex Jones, you might know from his show where he fights info constantly. It's them, it's his daughter and son-in-law who are literally enemies of the Republic. Jones blamed President Kushner for the media leaks from the White House, which he described as a jihad to go after hardcore conservatives and patriots. So Kushner is responsible not just for Syria, but also for the leaks. Now that one seems relatively free of anti-Semitism, but Jones also went on to say that the chemical weapons attacks in Syria were a hoax perpetrated by George Soros. And we know when they start talking about George Soros where they're going with that. And so look, these are different elements of white supremacy and anti-Semitism online, all coalescing around this way that they can relieve Donald Trump of any responsibility for his attacks.
Yeah. So look, there's the obvious angle of anti-Semitism, which I don't think anyone really needs to explain to our audience. You guys get it. But what I also find so interesting, and I asked myself this question quite a bit, as soon as Trump got elected, how does someone like Alex Jones, whose bread and butter is conspiracy theories, whose bread and butter is going after the president, how does he continue on with his business model? How does he continue to remain relevant when in reality he's in bed with the president? He loves the president. Yeah. He can't get enough of the president. He's on his knees pleasuring the president constantly, right? Not
right
literally,
right,
but you guys got it. Yeah, well, anyway, but so he just
literally
comes up with conspiracy theories geared toward the only Jewish component of Trump's administration? Mm-hmm. Really, that's what you do? The guy is crazy. The guy is literally
out of
his mind crazy. No, but
it's
look,
all of these different.
I know, but David Duke,
extremists,
white supremacist, whatever. I mean, he's everyone knows he's crazy, right? Same with Daily Stormer or whatever the hell they call themselves.
It's a white supremacy site.
White supremacist, right? So you know what to expect from them. I guess the reason why I'm focusing specifically on someone like Alex Jones is because he somehow miraculously convinced some portion of his audience to believe that he is a legitimate news source.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that people are waking up and realizing that the guy is just completely unhinged, right? He's unhinged. And he profits off sharing these ridiculous conspiracy theories and fear-mongering, and also he's selling snake oil. Like, I don't know what other like penis medication he's trying to slang on his show, but the guy is nuts, okay? So he shouldn't be taken seriously by anyone.
Yeah, I hope that some of the Trump supporters will still realize what's going on. I mean, we've seen on Reddit, some of the Donald Trump supporting forums are saying, well, like he said he wouldn't do this and now he's doing it. And when they sold out to the ISPs to give them your private browsing information, they seem to be waking up a little bit. But those mm-hmm. whose business model is going along with conspiracy theories, I assume that they would have perhaps some cognitive dissonance over the fact that they now have to support everything the federal government does. But if you can come up with secret societies and cabals inside of the White House, if you can all put it off on these subversive elements that you make up, then you can keep making money. And so I should have had more respect for how flexible these broken minds are.
Respect,
but again,
is not the right word to use in this context. But
I'm using it ironically.
Yeah.
My fear is that I don't like to see the continued anti-Semitism. I know some people want to distract you away from that, but that seems to be a constant throughout the campaign and into now. It's a scary part of politics throughout our history. It's a scary part of US politics. I don't like to see it continuing to this point. But anyway, so just be on the lookout. When you start to hear that things aren't Trump's fault, that it's something, someone else operating inside of the White House, it could be that people are just trying to relieve themselves of some awkward, uncomfortable cognitive dissonance.
How does Trump feel about the fact that all of these supporters believe that he's being manipulated, that he's so mentally weak and intellectually challenged that he's being manipulated by Jared Kushner? I don't know. How does Trump feel about it?
I don't know. We should poll the audience. But anyway, we do have to take one more short little break. When we come back, we've got a very shocking video of some police brutality against a young woman in Colorado. And then we're going to break down what people, citizens around the US are paying to cover up for the crimes of police officers in some of the biggest cities across America. We'll have that for you after this break. Welcome back to the show, everybody. A couple of tweets for you, and then we're going to get into breaking down what's going on with the police. It's a topic that is all too often forgotten in the reign of Donald Trump. Let's see, talking about some of the topics we just got done discussing. Ram L. J. Guzman says, there are cities without clean water. Millions of Americans don't have health care. Education is a privilege. The US has problems. It does. It does, however, have 59 fewer cruise missiles, although it will be buying replacements. Don't worry. It has money for that. Let's see. Javier Ortiz says, give a child a new toy and he'll want to use it. Honestly, I'm surprised it took this long talking about the missile strikes.
Are you going out of your way to mispronounce Latino names today?
Right. What did I say?
Right? It's Guzman and Ortiz.
What did I say?
Ortiz. And
oh, sorry. Okay, sorry. I have it's my dental work, I swear. I just got a crown put in.
I'm just like, because I know you know how to pronounce those names. I've heard you say them before.
Just calm down enough.
Okay, I'm sorry. Okay? I just want to do justice to my Latino brothers and sisters, okay? That's all I'm saying.
It's Latino, first of all. Okay, and then, that's true. That's not even getting to that. So, Marty Rosie. It's Marty Rosie, okay?
Okay, got
That's
it.
That's what it.
It
is.
You got the white
anyway,
name.
Anyway, Marty Rosie agrees with one of you. I see what you mean. agrees with the point that you made in the last segment saying Trump is a grown man. He should be able to make his own decisions. How can someone respect a man so easily influenced?
I agree, yeah.
I don't know, man. The human mind is an amazing thing, not for the reasons it should be, but for people's ability to twist it and contort it. To never have to rethink the things you already think. Like, I have a feeling about this person. I don't want to change it. It would be exhausting. I have a hard job. My relationship sucks. Just let me keep liking Donald Trump.
But it's so much harder to like find weird twists and turns in order to support your preconceived notions. I think it's a lot easier than people realize to just be like, huh, this is new information that goes against what I previously thought. Maybe I need to reform what I think, you know?
No.
Or evolve, in my opinion. No. Like, that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that.
You're weak. You're weak, damn it. You gotta be consistent.
Yeah, we're freaking monkeys, man.
Never rethink that's things, never change. Okay, let's jump into something pretty serious. We've got some very disturbing footage for you. So, this is cell phone video of a 22-year-old college student named Michaela Surratt being just devastated, brutalized by police in Colorado Springs. I believe this is earlier this week. Let's take a look. Look, that video was made available by Barstool Sports, someone who was witnessing an ongoing altercation between that woman, Michaela, and her boyfriend and the police and a bouncer taking it. Now, many people, either the videotaper or the people around laughing. It's not a laughing matter. That is about as serious a damaging act as you can take. Now, the police are going to say that you don't see the context. You don't know what happened before that video. But we also wouldn't have seen anything if not for that video. And so we know how these situations normally go when someone doesn't take their cell phone out. The police say she was being resistant, we had to do this. No one would really believe how devastating that body slam was, but you saw it now. There's no excuse for that. She didn't have a machine gun in her hand. That I wouldn't do that to my worst enemy.
So she was allegedly attempting to break up a fight between her boyfriend and some other guy. And apparently that's when cops got involved. Cops say that they had told her that she could leave at that moment, but she didn't want to leave. And I'm going to be absolutely honest, if I were in that situation, if I were in her shoes and I experienced my significant other in some sort of physical altercation, I'm not going to leave, yeah. Right? I'm going to stay there and make sure he's okay. So I don't blame her for not leaving. The cops are right. We don't see too much of what happened prior to the video, but
they
I
say
feel
that
like,
she shoulder checked a bouncer.
Oh, she shoulder checked the bouncer. Did she shoulder check the cop? And was the cop facing an imminent threat there to the point where he had to slam her to the floor like
I
that?
I mean, we saw her.
No.
Is her shoulder check an imminent threat to your life?
No. Her, she's a very thin young woman, mm-hmm. Okay? And even in that situation with the cop where there's a little bit of a back and forth, the cop isn't even really struggling with her. That's the amazing part. He lost his temper real quick.
Yeah.
And so I'm furious at whoever's in the background laughing at it as if it's like some entertainment, form of entertainment yeah. for that person. That is a human being who could have really gotten seriously and permanently hurt as a result of that.
Yeah.
And I'm also angry at the way that the cop handled it. Okay, if she is being, I can't even watch it, to be honest with you. Like, it's difficult to watch.
It's just brutal.
Sorry, guys. I can't watch it anymore. But every single time I do look at it, I'm just like, what made that cop think that that needed to be, you know, the end result? I mean, if she's being difficult,
apparently that's the culture.
That could have been handled in so many other ways, and he could have restrained her in so many other ways. I'm so happy that she's not, you know, paralyzed from maybe breaking her neck or getting a concussion.
It's not impossible that you could have died.
Exactly.
Now we have a statement from the police. So this is a Fort Collins police chief saying, as with most events of this type, the short publicly available video does not have the context or content of the full event. Additionally, rarely in use of force situations is there agreement from all the parties involved as to the appropriateness, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, that's true. We might disagree from time to time when we see some video. I think every human being on earth can agree that there's no way that that's appropriate. If she had just whispered into his ear, I am a chemical bomb about to explode, okay, you can slam her. Aside from that, anything operating inside of the bounds of reality, no, that was not appropriate. He also, by the way, said this. Now, the question would be, they have body cameras, apparently. That's mm-hmm. great. So body cameras are good. You can get more context. But Chief Hutto said that there are police body camera videos of the incident, but he will not release them because the incident is still under investigation. Okay, well then spare us the you guys don't have all the context. You haven't seen everything. If you have the video and you can show it to us and it makes your cop look better as a result, the fact that you're hiding it seems just a little bit suspicious at this point.
Yeah, I agree.
And then that's a quick reminder that while I think that the spread of body cameras is a good thing and it will lead to slightly more justice, it is by no means a solution to all the problems we have with police, especially considering that police all too often either don't release the video footage or the camera's accidentally turned off or it breaks. Apparently, if you jostle it, they break pretty easily. That's something that we have to be on the lookout for. But that was unconscionable what happened to that woman. Anyway, let's go a little bit broader now. Police misconduct around the country is costing cities huge sums of money every single year, and the settlements are only getting bigger and more numerous as the years actually pass. So the LA Times had a great breakdown of some of the recent settlements here just in LA. The county's annual payouts because of misconduct have jumped from $5.6 million to nearly $51 million during just the last 5 years. A gigantic leap because of illegal acts taken by police. So that $51 million is a lot of money. And you might think, well, how can the police afford to pay that? Well, they can afford to pay that because they're not paying that. If you live in LA, if you're paying taxes, you're paying for that. Now, how does this actually break down? How do you get to $51 million? Well, $6 million went to a woman who had been raped by a sheriff's deputy during a traffic stop. $7 million resolved multiple lawsuits after deputies in West Hollywood mistakenly shot two hostages, killing one and seriously wounding the other. And then there's a variety of other settlements having to do with sexual assault, excessive force, shooting unarmed suspects, and wrongful imprisonment. Now, some of these things are going to happen in a city of this many police, this many people. Hostages do occasionally get shot. These are tense situations. But I believe you reported on that situation. Mm-hmm. They apparently went in guns blazing. They shot up the car with a couple of women thinking it was a suspect at some point. It's this sort of just crazy behavior, shooting before thinking and having very little accountability that ends up costing the city $51 million in addition to all the lives lost.
Right. So I think oftentimes when we talk about the issue of better police training and police brutality, what happens is we will look at one very specific case of a specific person who was shot and killed, an unarmed individual, whether it's Walter Scott or Tamir Rice. We'll look at that case and we'll immediately judge the individual who was shot and killed. And so the conversation isn't really about a broader context and what we're seeing among police throughout the country. And the reality is, regardless of what you care about, let's say you don't care about these victims at all and you think that they're all so-called thugs and criminals and they all deserve to be shot and killed even if they were unarmed. Okay, we'll take that part out of it and focus on how this type of behavior personally affects you. This is your taxpayer money, okay? So when these cases need to be adjudicated, when these settlements need to be paid out, when these judgments are read and these police departments have to pay whatever the judge decides is the proper amount that the victims deserve, that is your money. It is not the cops, right? And so I'm not going to sit here and say all these cops are terrible. And so, you know, no, that's not what I'm trying to say at all. What I'm trying to say is bad police behavior and a lack of effective training affects every single one of us, regardless of what our race is, regardless of what our socioeconomic status is. And that's why it's important that we hone in on this issue and find real solutions. If we see bad behavior and we know that that bad behavior is accurate, like it's reported accurately and we have evidence for it, there needs to be proper consequences and we need to train them better. There needs to be a little more hesitation before shots are fired. And right now it seems like there's no hesitation at all. I mean, a cop raped someone and the county had to pay $6 million. $6 million, that's our money.
And that's just one of the sexual assaults that were settled in LA. And so as you point out, this affects everybody. It also affects every city, basically. This is not just an LA problem. So LA Times did a great job getting that information, but then I cast a wider net. I looked for evidence from around the country and I found it. This is a growing problem. Let's see, New York City spent $228.5 million settling police misconduct lawsuits just in 2016. That works out to $27 for every single New Yorker. Washington DC paid at least $31.6 million in court judgments or settlements since 2005. And the Chicago Sun-Times reported back in 2014 that the city had already paid out nearly $500 million in settlements over the past decade. That's not including 2015 and 2016. And I think you can think of some legal troubles with the police in Chicago in those years. So this is a problem that goes from big cities to small. The numbers for Baltimore were incredibly high. This is affecting your, if you're in a city, it's affecting your state if not. And there are ways we can deal with this. And if we reform the way that police are trained, we don't just get more justice on a daily basis. We don't just stop people from being killed unnecessarily. We can also save an incredible amount of money that can be reinvested into communities and can produce a lot of good over time.
The whole point of having police is to go after the bad guys, protect the good guys, not to have the cops act as the bad guys and then have us foot the bill as a result.
Exactly. Yeah, these numbers are just ridiculous, but there is something we can do about it. Unfortunately, we're unlikely to get any help at the federal level in the next few years. We know what Jeff Sessions is, we know what he represents, but it's still possible to change things at a local level, certainly at a state level, and you can ward off some of these unnecessary crimes and the settlements by doing that. Now we're going to break in just a little bit over a minute to go to the second hour. Before you tease a couple of stories, I just want to thank two of our members. I want to give them some shout outs. Really worried about the pronunciation now, I'm not going to lie to you.
Sorry.
So, member Lydia Trailovic.
That was
sounds reasonable.
Sounds pretty good.
Thank you for being a member. And Gina Mignola. Thank you for your membership. It's incredibly important, especially during these days of YouTube apocalypse. You being members allows us to be both independent and also to weather ridiculous storms in the policies of YouTube from time to time. So what can we look forward to in the next hour?
I am going to share an interaction that I had with a young troll on Instagram.
I don't know about this.
Yes, it's entertaining and I'm going to actually ask you guys for advice. I think it's important. So,
so you're going to continue this confrontation going forward?
Possibly, okay. Based on the advice that our members give me. You don't want to miss the details on that.
Okay, and I know that you're also excited. You've got a block breaking down Bill O'Reilly's troubles and also some ways that he's apparently benefiting from being in the spotlight again.
It's absurd.
It's
yes.
ridiculous how yeah. the system works. But it turns out it's actually it's good to be rich and powerful.
Yeah, it turns out. Weird.
Works out pretty well.
Weird.
Yeah. So with that, continue to tweet us at hashtag TYTLive, both about the stories we covered in the first hour today, also what you'd like to see discussed on the show tomorrow. And we'll be back right after this break.